Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Peter Coyote, your moderator for today's program. And this series is part of the club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. It's my very, very special pleasure and honor to introduce our special guest, Michael Krasny.
Welcome. Thank you.
Host of KQED Radio's Forum, to which I'm a regular listener, the author of a new book, Let There Be Laughter, A Treasury of Great Jewish Humor and What It Means. Michael is also someone I'm very proud to call a friend, and if there is such a thing as reincarnation, I intend to come back as his memory, which is astounding. He has, of course, been the host of Forum since 1993. He's interviewed many of the leading icons of our time, including lesser icons like myself. Since 1970, he's been a very popular teacher of English, professor of English, excuse me, at San Francisco State University. But what brings us here is a shared passion of Michael and mine. Michael has been telling Jewish jokes since his bar mitzvah, and it has been said by others and will be attested by me that he knows more than anyone on the planet. I have never been able to tell him a joke without him beating me to the punchline. Not ever, not once, in a long and cordial friendship. So his new book, Let There Be Laughter, borrows from such Jewish comedy legends and new voices as well: Jackie Mason, Mel Brooks, Joan Rivers, Larry David, Sarah Silverman, Jerry Seinfeld, Amy Schumer. And with his background as a radio host and a scholar, Michael delves deeply into the themes of these music. He has a kind of these jokes. I'm turning 75 in 2 days. Just give me a pass. So get ready to laugh, and please welcome Michael Krasny. So Michael seemed surprised that I prepared for this thing. It's like if you're going into the lion's den, you better at least have a stone and a slingshot. Michael, since tonight's topic is Jewish humor, I'd like to concentrate just for a minute on the adjective in that phrase and ask you first when you realized that you were Jewish and what it meant to you and how you conceived of it.
You know, Samuel Beckett, one of my idols, said that he remembered being in the womb. I don't have that privilege, but it started pretty early. My mother claimed that when I was about 3 years old, I would go up to people on the public buses that we took and say, "Are you Jewish?" and ask them that. So there was a strong sense of identity fairly early on. You could call it precocity, I suppose, if you were being flattering about it. But it was something that I caught on to at a very early age, the sense that I came from a Jewish home. We kept kosher. We had an older woman with white hair that we called Bubby, who called me a paskunyak, for those of you who know Yiddish, your Yiddish. And it was very much a part of the fiber of my life, and it was part of really my own sensibility. There's a Philip Roth distinction between Judaism and Jewishness, and it's an important one to me because I think the two flowed together much more for me when I was younger. But the Jewishness always was very much a part of me.
Yeah, the Judaism is a practice.
Yeah.
And the Jewishness is a club that you can't get out of.
Well, it also, for many years, involved clubs you couldn't get into. And that's one of the things I wanted to establish. I mean, there are certainly a lot of jokes. There was a Jewish comic by the name of Jack Carter, who some of the old-timers here may remember. He's very popular back in the day. And he told a joke, in fact, and this joke is really time-set. It was at a time when Barry Goldwater was well-known as a politician. In your heart, you know he's right and all that, ran against Lyndon Johnson. I just made an allusion to that this morning on Forum because we were talking about last night's vice presidential debate. And I was wont to talk about the nuclear issue because it did come up last night. So here's Jack Carter saying, this is my favorite of all Jewish jokes, and it goes something like this. He said, Barry Goldwater's real name, of course, was Goldwasser, and a lot of people knew that he came from a Phoenix family that had Jewish roots to it. So the story was that somebody named Schwartz looks in this club that he couldn't get into, that wouldn't admit him or any other Jews, and he sees the name Goldwater. So it's really, like I said, a time-bound joke. And he calls up Goldwater, gets his phone number and calls him at home and says, Goldwater, how come you're in the club and they won't let me in the club? I'm Schwartz and I can't get in this club, but you are in this club. Mr. Schwartz, he said, let me just put your mind at ease. He said, my name is Goldwater. It's not Goldwasser, it's not Goldwasser, it's Goldwater. He said, I'm an Episcopalian. He said, my father was an Episcopalian. My grandfather, Oliver Shalom, he was an Episcopalian. It's Jack Carter's favorite joke. But there are so many of those jokes. You know, Groucho Marx couldn't get into a club because it was restricted and he was Jewish. And he said, when they told him, you can't even swim in the swimming pool here. We don't want any Jews in our swimming pool. He said, my daughter is half Jewish. Can she go in up to her waist? You know, there were those kind of things.
So obviously humor was part of your formulation. How did you discover that the two went together, Jewishness and humor?
Well, there were always Jewish jokes that I was exposed to. In the book, I said one of the first ones I told, and I took great joy, almost rapture, in telling them, because I like to point out in the book the difference between telling a joke and also putting it into text. But I think, and by the way, somehow this hyperbole came up. There's a Talmudic saying, make me more than I am and you make me less. I don't know if I know more Jewish jokes than anybody on the planet, but it has been said. It's never been empirically proven, and I don't know how you would begin to do that. But I remember going up to my social studies teacher, who was a kind of curmudgeon guy and sourpuss, and we were talking about the Middle East, and I said, Mr. Lehman, you know what the fastest thing on water is? This will be a time-bound joke, too. And he said, what? I said, a Jew in a canoe on the Suez Canal. And suddenly, Mr. Lehman was in paroxysms of laughter. He was almost doubled up, actually holding himself. So I realized that there was a power in humor at a very young age, and it was a power to make people laugh and to put them at ease and make somebody who was, like I said, a countenance that was almost lugubrious actually be happy with hearing a joke.
Did you ever hear Lenny Bruce's explanation of how the Jews discovered humor?
Tell us, Peter.
They're hauling stones in the desert, you know, for the Egyptian pharaohs. And there's a guard there with a whip. And Morty falls over a stone, or Murray falls over a stone. And Saul makes a little joke, and the guard cracks up. And they do something else, and the guard cracks up. And they realize instantly that as long as the guard is laughing, they're not hauling the stone. That's the beginning.
And I have to dovetail that with the joke. It was one of the few jokes of my sister who has a fairly, shall we say, high bar about jokes, too, because we've heard them since we were growing up. The joke is of a man who goes back in time in a time machine and winds up in a galleon in the Roman times. And there's, again, somebody with a whip who's just beating everybody and telling him to row faster. And he doesn't even know what the heck he's doing here. You know, he's rowing and everything. He's whipping him. He turns to the guy next to him and says, are you supposed to tip the whipper? Sorry.
So here's a quote from your book. As a teacher of literature, I came to view jokes like fiction as portals to knowledge and ways to see how the powers of storytelling and laughter are linked. So my question was, did you conceive of laughter as the purpose or the payoff of a good story? And if not, why was laughter so important?
Well, I've been teaching fiction all my adult life, and there aren't that many stories really that are funny. I mean, the truth of the matter is that a lot of really great literature tends to be in the tragic mode and tends to be downbeat. I say this about not only novels, but short stories, and of course you could say about other genres like drama. But I found fairly early on that jokes were like narratives, that they had subtextual meaning. That, I mean, I read Freud as a kid, and I was reading a book of his that many of you may know called Jokes in the Unconscious, or Wit in the Unconscious, depending how you translate it. And he talked about jokes as releasing aggression and releasing, of course, sexual repression and also releasing aggression. And so you could tell jokes and really try to interpret them, I realized, fairly early stage as portals, not only perhaps to the unconscious, and to some extent I've gone away from a lot of that psychoanalytic jargon that I was, it was like mother's milk to me at one time. But the truth of the matter is that the narratives not only give you the opportunity to laugh, especially if you get the joke, if you understand the joke, but they also have meaning in them. And I found this navigating between telling jokes, putting them into text, and not only jokes, but stories and anecdotes and folklore. The canvas is pretty wide in my book. I found that I really wanted to explain them too. And, you know, it's funny because some of the Amazon reviews have been coming out, and they've, I'm pleased to say, they've all been, you know, 4 or 5 stars. One guy gave me a 2-star, and he said, yeah, the jokes are fine, but leave the analysis. It's like, leave the cannolis, you know. And I thought, well, there are going to be people who feel that way. To some people, it's just a joke book. On the other hand, I got an email this morning from a friend of mine, Bob Kaiser, who used to be political editor of the Washington Post, who said, I gave your book to the book editor of the Washington Post. Very kind of him to do that. He did it with my last book, and they did a review. But the book editor said, a joke book? And Bob's riposte to that was, this is what we need. We need laughter, right? But it's not just a joke book. And he tried to convince him and did kind of a little bit of a salesmanship in terms of saying, this book has a lot more in it, which I hope it does.
We must have come from the same kind of house. My mother worshipped Freud, and she would do really irritating things like she would tell you a lie, you'd catch her in a lie, and she'd get angry, and I'd get angry, and she'd say, paging Dr. Freud. As if any anger at a parent were edible. She had everyone in the family in therapy except herself. And she made more Freudian slips than anyone I've ever known. My favorite being, I was getting dressed to go to my high school junior prom, and I had misbuttoned a shirt. And my mother saw it, and she was very embarrassingly flirtatious with me. And she came sidling up and pressed herself against me and began rebuttoning my shirt, saying, "Darling, I'll be buttoning your fly at your wedding."
Okay. I think Dr. Freud may not even want to deal with that one. Let me actually tell you, and Peter knows a lot of these jokes, of course. We spent one afternoon just exchanging jokes for what seemed like it could have gone on endlessly. But it's kind of my favorite Freudian type of joke, or it has a Freudian element to it. So this man goes to a psychiatrist. He's been seeing the shrink for quite a while. And he says, "You know, I actually had a dream about you last night." And the shrink said, "You had a dream about me? Well, let's deal with that. Tell me everything that you did from the point of your waking up until you got here." And he said, "Well, everything I did, it was a normal morning for me. I got up from sleeping in the dream I had, went in, took a shower, brushed my teeth, went downstairs and had a donut," and the shrink says, "You call that a breakfast?"
So you tell it, you. One of the things that really interests me about Jewish jokes is there are these undercurrents that operate under them that are sometimes not quite so funny. And you tell a story in your section on Jewish grandmothers of a woman friend whose grandmother insisted on holding her hand every day when she walked from the house to the driveway to pick up the paper. And she did this from the time she was 8 until she was 18. And I wondered, you know, if whether or not you thought that such preternatural alertness might be related to 5,700 years of living with the uncertainty of exile, oppression, pogroms, and danger. And could that very kind of heightened awareness be one of the engines behind Jewish humor?
Oh, I think it's definitely, and it's very astute of you. We were talking a little bit before we came in here about a novelist who I admire a lot and who I mentioned in the book, named Mordechai Richler, because Peter's going to make a movie in Montreal and braving the cold up there and all the rest of it. And Richler was a very funny writer. I had one opportunity to interview him, and unfortunately he was somewhat intoxicated, but that's another story. But he would write about, you know, the sort of things that went on during his boyhood in Montreal. He wrote a book called The Street, which was very not all that well known, like his novels, some of which were made into movies. Some of you may remember, in fact, Joshua Then and Now, or Dudy Kravitz, which was really a classic movie based on novels by Mordechai Richler. I got to get the thread here. Now, you were asking me about that pain, and I thought of Richler
because I was asking you about heightened awareness and anxiety.
Exactly. Richler writes about going on a picnic, for example, with his family. And he's luxuriating in the feeling of being with his family, his loved ones, his children, his wife. And suddenly he's thinking of all the things that can go wrong. You know, I mean, not only natural disasters, but he's thinking about, you know, he hears a motor, it could be Hell's Angels, you know, coming over the hill to do harm to him and so forth. It's almost like an embedded collective memory of some kind. It's in the DNA, and it does, I mean, we know things now about epigenetics that we never knew before that can come through the genetic line and the lineage, and it's a lot of trying to understand and get to the heart of those mysteries that I think we're talking about here. How much do we carry with us? Not only talking about Jews, but whatever lineage you are. How much do you carry with you ancestral memories and memories that go back maybe even to antediluvian and, you know, stages of development that are really almost primordial? I don't know that we know the answers.
You know, my mother told me once that after I was born, I lived in Englewood, New Jersey, where Charles Lindbergh's child was kidnapped maybe a year before I was born. And she told me that for the first year that I was born, my dad stalked the halls with a pistol every night. He would not sleep. He had this kind of paranoia. His father killed his horse with a hammer when it bit him in front of him. And I just sometimes think the same way about this cascade, Buddhists would call it karma, of collective history that kind of embodies a people. You can't separate the culture from the psyches, really.
Let me just fill you up, though, just a thought after you said that about how Richler made me think about the fact, and because he writes about this specifically, it's always trying to second-guess God when you're thinking about all the terrible things that can happen. Because you know, I mean, especially if talking about those with a strong faith, they know that God can give just as he can take. And disasters can happen, and they can happen inexplicably, and you can be in some ways completely surprised or shocked by just the nature of things and how they unfold. We're going to get pretty serious here, though, if we continue to pursue this.
Well, I'm going to steer you to a joke in a minute, but one of the things that occurs to me as you just said that is that common to all the Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, is that they're dualistic religions. There's God, there's evil, there's good and evil. People are always on the horns of a contradiction and dilemma. And that led me to think about the fact that the double bind is a big part of Jewish humor and Jewish guilt. And I was hoping maybe you would tell the joke about the sad young man whose mother hated every girl he brought home.
Yeah, it's a great joke. And I heard it before I went to press, so I was able to get it in the book. It's one of the few jokes I hadn't heard, and I love it. It's about a young man who's in a congregation, and the rabbi is up on what they call the bima, you know, where we, Peter and I are. He looks out at the congregation. He sees this young man. This young man looks really very doleful. He looks sad. And the rabbi is a compassionate, loving man. And as soon as the service is over, he goes to the young man. He says, you know, I couldn't help noticing you look terribly sad. Can you tell me, is something bothering you? You can open up to me. I'm a rabbi. And the young man says, okay, I'm going to tell you what's bothering me. I meet these women and I fall in love with them. I've had a succession of them. I bring them home and one after another, my mother rejects them and doesn't like them. In fact, hates them. What can I do, Rabbi? I mean, my mother's just too critical. My mother has the bar too high. And the rabbi said, no, wait. I may have some advice for you. He said, you know, with the internet now, you can find out all kinds of things about people. Why don't you look on the internet for a potential mate and find someone who has things in common with your mother? Maybe similar interests or things they can talk about. He said, Rabbi, I hadn't even thought of that. It's a wonderful idea. I'll try it. I'll try anything. 3 weeks go by, and there he is once again among the congregation looking more sad than he did the first time the rabbi saw him. Okay, so the service is over, and the rabbi goes over to him, and he says, did you follow my advice? You look sadder than you even did before. He says, yes, Rabbi, I followed your advice. He says, so what happened? He says, I found a young woman. She was lovely. She looked so much like my mother. It was unbelievable. Not only that, but she talked like my mother. They had similar interests. She even, it turned out, cooked like my mother. Rabbi says, what was wrong? My father hated her. All right. It's a great joke.
So you feel safe saying that double binds are kind of a common core of Jewish humor?
I try to get at that double bind and also the paradoxical nature of it and, frankly, the ambivalent nature of it. There's a lot of Jewish humor that's binary, you know, as you suggest. It lifts up your spirits, it makes you laugh and everything, but then when you start to analyze it, you realize there's a sad context to it, too, and there's something that really has to do even with misery and suffering. Although, you know, I love the joke about, they used to say, well, isn't all Jewish humor based on suffering? No, and if I hear that one more time, I'm going to kill myself.
Yeah. Exactly. You know, when I was young, maybe this happened to you too, I was sort of obsessed with the Holocaust. When you get to an age and you hear about it and you start wondering, you know, well, couldn't they do anything? You know, my father was a tough guy. Could he help me? Didn't the Jews fight back? And I started reading. And one of the books I read cited a very kind of cynical and clever thing that psychologists that Hitler hired did. They would flood the ghetto with two colors of identity cards, red and yellow, and they would pass them out at random. And all the people in the ghetto would be thinking, wait a minute, Saul got a red one. He's a communist. I got a yellow. I'm okay. The next month, they would take all of one color, and then they would send out new cards. And they were just random. They meant nothing. But they knew enough about the way Jews would think and count the hairs on a dog's back, or they would march people up to a hill and they'd have a soldier arbitrarily at the top sending people right and left, knowing that the people in the back of the line would be watching and trying to figure out, was there an order, was there a symbol, where to try to be. So obviously this is something about our culture, Jewishness, that other people could study and identify.
And have.
Yeah. So you cite the Yiddish word yichus, the prestige that comes from learning. My sister once said to me, in our house, it would be better to be a thief than to be stupid. It often appears that the fundamental intention of Jewish people is to be smart. What do you make of that?
Well, there's a great tradition of study among Jews and of immersing themselves in particularly, you know, Torah, Talmud, because that would bring you closer to the power of God, or at least apprehending God in a closer and more intimate way. And that kind of Talmudic study is one thing at the root, but it was also a great belief long, long ago in education, in the power of education, and the fact that education, especially, talk about Yichus, there's a seminal Jewish-American novel by a writer named Abraham Kahn, that's C-A-H-A-N, who was for many years the editor of The Forward, the Yiddish newspaper. And Abraham Kahn, in his book, The Rise of David Levinsky, which really is, like I say, a seminal American Jewish novel, this one character in the book says to this other character, when you come to America, you leave your yichus behind. In other words, you have to pursue something that's going to make
material
a living or
goal.
Success or, you know, et cetera. And the truth of the matter is that yichus became translated in a different way, I think, in America, in the whole hybridized experience. It became translated into success, and success, and one way of achieving it was education. So education became paramount in so many Jewish homes, and I really try to shed some light on this and illuminate it, just how important it was. There's a lot of jokes, of course, about, you know, Jewish boys being doctors and they have to study for medicine and so forth, but also about Jewish boys being successful. In fact, I'm sure a lot of this crowd may be NPR enthusiasts. How's that for a great deduction? and thank you for your support. But there's an old saw about, actually it was Ira Glass, a name familiar to many of you, who told me this on the air and used it on the air. He said to me, "They're really, Jewish identity is divided into two things. They're book Jews and money Jews." And at the time I thought, this is a pretty preposterous statement, you know, I mean, it's hyperbole and again, it's too generalized and so forth. But to some extent, in terms of a lot of Jewish identity, it actually holds up. I mean, there are hybridizations. There are Jews who want success, material success, and leave their yichus behind. And then there are Jews who want the yichus, which is, again, the sense of being... I was always a book Jew, so I was always pretty much a poor Jew. But, you know, that was certainly an identity that had a lot to do with how I was raised and being brought up in a Jewish home.
I remember reading that in the turn of the 20th century, in the early, you know, first two decades of the 20th century, the Jewish immigrants were distinguished from all others, the Germans, the Poles, the Italians, the Swedes, because they were 100% literate. Yeah. The women, as well as the men, had to be able to read the Torah, and because of that, they also brought with them the most advanced and sophisticated ideas of Europe.
Yeah, but remember Yentl and all that. You know, the women couldn't well, go yeah, as far there as they wanted to. I just have to mention, since you mentioned a couple of things, both the Holocaust and the sense of Jews learning, that assimilation is a very important theme in my book because a lot of humor comes out of assimilation, the recognition of it. And there really is a sense of Jews assimilating quickly and learning language quickly. I mean, there's a great old joke about some of this goes back to Leo Rosten and the joys of speaking Yiddish. Man is learning English, and he's asked to spell a word, and the word is cultivate. And he spells the word correctly. Then he says, can you use it in a sentence? Says, yeah. He says, I was waiting for the bus, but it was too cultivate, so I took the subway. There's a wonderful charm to that. But, you know, you get back into the fact that we're facing now. I mean, how do you make humor out of the Holocaust? The truth of the matter is that we're in a kind of post-Shoah, post-Holocaust humor phase, I recognize. It started with Mel Brooks, and then you had Seinfeld with the
Soup Nazi.
The Soup Nazi, and you have all of you, and Larry David, you know, with, we're going to meet two survivors, and the survivor in Auschwitz is Sally, and the other survivors from the TV show Survivor, you know. Suddenly, these kinds of things, which once were really not to be joked about under any circumstances, and I said it started with Mel Brooks because it was all springtime for Hitler and Busby Berkeley and all that. Let me just tell you a joke, though, that I love about assimilation, and it came out of really an interview I did. This is the only Jewish joke I think I've told on the air until I was on Friday with Mina Kim on the Forum show. So the joke was told by me because Vikram Seth, any of you recognize that?
Yeah.
Wonderful Indian novelist. He wrote a book about his uncle who married a woman who was a child of the Holocaust and escaped from it. His uncle was a dentist, and they lived in London together. Very touching memoir. So it reminded me of this joke, and I actually told it on the air because it shows, again, the quickness with which Jews can actually assimilate, the deftness of their assimilation, learning another culture and so forth. So the joke begins with a man who escapes from the Holocaust, a young man. He goes to England, crosses over the border, and leaves his father behind. He had no choice. His father, by the way, I tell in the book about Isaac Singer, the great Yiddish writer, I said, tell me, right after he won the Nobel Prize, I said, do you believe in free will? I said it very solemnly, right at Herbst Theater. He said, I have no choice. Okay. Let me go back for a moment to the joke on the air. The joke on the air was simply this. He has to leave his father behind, and he's become so wealthy in England that all the Jews are being taken off and carted to the charnel houses and to the furnaces and the showers and the rest of it. But he stages this daring rescue with all kinds of help. Helicopter goes into the ghetto, the Polish ghetto, and saves the father and brings him into England. Extraordinarily daring rescue. And the son meets the father, and he says to the father, I want you to think, Pa, of yourself now as an Englishman, because that's what I think of myself as. We found sanctuary in this country. I've made a small fortune here. I've been successful. Please, from now on, think of yourself as an Englishman. And the first thing he does is he takes his father to the tonsorial place on Bond Street and gets him fit for a beautiful new suit. Takes him to the haberdashery and gets him fit for a beautiful new suit. Then he takes him to the tonsorial place, and they're cutting his hair, and they're cutting his payas, you know, the curls that are on. And the old man starts sobbing, and he's sobbing convulsively. And his son says, Pa, you're sobbing? Why? Because you're losing your Jewish identity? No, I'm sobbing because we lost India.
So we have
the speed of assimilation, yeah.
We have some interesting questions. They're directed at you directly. The first one is a two-part question. The first part is, how has humor served the Jewish people?
Oh, I think it served them wonderfully. You know, there's a woman named Marilyn Yalom, who is actually a friend of Leslie, my wife, and me, and also is married to Erwin Yalom, who's a famous name in psychiatry, kind of one of the founders of group therapy, and a novelist who wrote When Nietzsche Wept and some wonderful books. Marilyn Yalom said to me recently, I want to tell you about a book called Beyond Good and Evil. Sounds like Nietzsche to me, also. But she said it's a book about actually it's called Beyond Good and Evil, and it was a Holocaust memoir by a woman who said they were sustained. They were in an Anne Frank kind of situation, if there is such an archetype as that. I mean, they were hiding in somebody's attic and barely managing to stay outside of the purview of the Gestapo. And at one point, they realized that one of the few books they had was a book of Jewish humor, and they said it sustained them. They nurtured off it. I mean, it gave them nurture, I should say, and really sustained them until they were able to make their way into freedom and escape. And I kept thinking about that and how it's almost a metaphor for so much of what Jews have had in the way of humor to have as an ally. I came to the conclusion, in fact, a number of years ago, I was teaching a course in Jewish humor at Esalen Institute, but I was. It sounds like a setup for a joke, doesn't it?
It does.
And suddenly I thought to myself, it was like a bit of I call it an epiphany or something, the golem, the whole story of the golem, which Michael Chabon, in other words, others have made famous, the idea of this Frankenstein creature like Mary Shelley writes about, created out of clay. But in the Jewish folklore, and this was all said in Prague for the most part, the golem was able to defend Jews from their adversaries and also defeat their adversaries and destroy them. That's Jewish humor.
Yeah.
I mean, it just came to me like this. You have these rare insights in life like that, and it was one of those insights that was almost blinding. It was like you use that Joycean word epiphany. I think we use it perhaps too easily and too promiscuously, perhaps. But boy, it really was an epiphany. It's been used defensively, and it's been used offensively, and it's been used to sustain a whole tribe, a whole people.
Here's the second part of that question. Can it help Netanyahu?
What of Netanyahu?
Can it help Netanyahu?
I think the thing about Bibi Netanyahu is, and I'm no fan, serious problems with the way he has been leading Israel. And most of all, he's a politician, I think. He's done some good things, he's done some bad things, I suppose, like most politicians, but I've certainly, in my private life, not on air, but in my private life, been quite critical, especially of the settlements and ongoing struggles to move toward peace. But I think he has a sense of humor. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find many Jews of that generation who don't have a sense of humor, who haven't been somehow inculcated, too strong a word perhaps, but in some sense of Jewish humor.
Well, here's a question that actually I shared because my people are Sephardic Jews, and this person asks, the examples of Jewish humor you give are rooted in Eastern European Ashkenazi culture. Is there a similar tradition of humor among Sephardic Jews?
No. Sorry.
Well, I have an idea why, but you.
Well,
go.
No offense, Peter, but I did a lot of research on this. I wanted to find out what the Sephardic humor was, and you have to really study Ladino, and I never did study Ladino to understand Sephardic culture in a deeper way. But they were a minority, and they had their own culture, and they had a culture which was very strong in its Jewish identity, but it had a whole different history behind it, and it had. The Ashkenazi was somewhat hegemonic. I mean, that's in terms of humor, certainly. Mm-hmm. I also had to distinguish in my own mind what Israeli humor is, because that also is distinctive from Ashkenazi and what we would call Yiddishkeit, that is Yiddish culture humor. It's a different variety. It's a different brand of humor.
So we often think of performers as being vain and self-aggrandizing, but there's often a kind of savage ego side in Jewish humor. I'm thinking of your citations of Joan Rivers describing her lack of sex appeal by joking that prison guards were using nude photos of her to curb the sex drives of death row prisoners, yeah. or that she wore open-toed shoes to show off her breasts. And
that made Isabel Allende laugh so hard that I think she urinated, but that's...
Yeah. I'm wondering if you agree with this assessment, and if so, why do you think this might be, and if not, why not?
A lot of the humor is traditionally self-lacerating, and especially, interestingly enough, among Jewish women. I came across a show that Amy Schumer did, and she's half Jewish, but she identifies as Jewish. I mean, her mother was not Jewish. She's related to Charlie Schumer. She was talking on the Jon Stewart show, and they were doing a little shtick together. Jon Stewart actually had, I found an old clip of his where he was doing, some of you probably know this bit, where he was comparing Easter and Passover, and he says, come on, Mishpacha, he's talking, you know, in Yiddish, to fellow Jews, like Jewish kin, we got to step up our game here. I mean, look what they have. They have a basket with eggs and candy, and what do we have? You know, we have horseradish, we have dead lamb, you know.
Yeah.
This is not going to win. All right. So Amy's, Schumer is on Stewart's show, and they flash a picture of her and Jennifer Lawrence, who is decidedly not Jewish. And, you know, they're BFFs now, was what they were saying. And he said, look how beautiful Jennifer is. Look at what a gorgeous movie star she is. He says, look at me. You know who I look like, she says to Stewart? Alfred Hitchcock. All right. And I thought, there's that element again. And so many Jewish women, unfortunately, have that kind of self-lacerating. But look, it goes back to the whole role of the Shlemiel, too, which is a folkloric character. You know, I have a whole chapter on schmucks and Shlemiels. And schmuck doesn't mean what it's come to mean, kind of losers. There's a movie called Dinner with Schmucks, and it was sort of getting away from the real meaning of the word, which was a villain. You know, somebody, Lenny Bruce, in fact, said that he was first arrested in San Francisco for obscenity because there was an undercover cop who understood Yiddish and used the word schmuck. There's, I think, a whole sense of, look, I'm going to make fun of myself before somebody else ridicules me, or I'm going to put that out there to show maybe even my humility, or that I can be self-denigrating, and it have to be that way because really in some ways I do not necessarily value myself. I mean, a lot of the Shlemiel humor is rooted in that sense of bad luck. Shlemazel is the real meaning of bad luck. That, you know, the Shlemiel, as Sandy Koufax pointed out one year when they said, the great Joe Gargiulo, great baseball announcer, why aren't you pitching? And by the way, we're missing a very important game tonight. So thank you for coming in spite of this winner-take-all game. Joe Garagiola said, why aren't you pitching? And Sandy Koufax said, I guess I'm Jewish and it's Yom Kippur and Jews were celebrating and shouting hosannas and loving the fact that probably one of the greatest pitchers of all time had identified himself as Jewish. And Joe Garagiola said, you know, what is Shlemiel? He said, because Koufax said, because you could call me a Shlemiel. And Koufax made that distinction. The Shlemiel is the one who goes into the restaurant and knocks over the soup, and the Shlemazel is the one it spills on. It's the Shlemazel, and bad luck. Okay. So a lot of Jews tended to see themselves as, you know, it's a Charlie Chaplin figure. He was not necessarily, that is, a lot of people think Charlie Chaplin was Jewish. He wasn't. But it's a Shlemiel character. It's the loser. It's the guy, if those of you remember Little Abner, had the cloud over his head. Joe Blixfix. Peter said it right. It's a hard name to pronounce because, you know, it's an impossible name to pronounce on the face.
No vowels.
No vowels. Just like a lot of the Bosnian things that we faced as an announcer. Are you kidding me? You know, during the Bosnian conflict, I have to say these names. So the sense of having to make fun of yourself and ridicule yourself again to sort of neutralize things, to make things lighter and softer upon yourself as well. And there's a lot of self-inflation in Jewish humor, too, grandiosity, as you said, but there's just as much of that other. And there's, again, the polarities and the binary sense of it. So, for example, you think about somebody like Rodney Dangerfield, and so much of his humor is based on this, just, and it's got that chigaboom that, you know, goes back to Yiddish culture, that cadence and euphony to it. He says, you know, I met a beautiful woman. She said, come to my house tonight. Nobody will be there. I went. Nobody was there. You know, it's just making fun of himself in that Shlemiel way. And so much is embedded in, this is not Rodney Dangerfield. Rodney Dangerfield said, you know, I went to the doctor. And this is an old Hedy Youngman joke, too. I went to the doctor. The doctor said, you're sick. I said, I'll get another opinion. He says, okay, you're ugly, too. You know, it's just chigaboom. They have that kind of fire behind them. It's an old Yiddish one like that. I went to the rabbi because I was so troubled by so many people who were so ignorant and apathetic. And I said, Rabbi, why are so many people so ignorant and so apathetic? And the rabbi said, I don't know and I don't care. You know? So just keep going like that. You can keep them going like that. But they make fun of a kind of individuality that's identified with Jewishness, Jewish identity, and peoplehood.
So speaking of self-laceration, before I have to give this radio reminder. Audience member wants to know how you rank Woody Allen among Jewish comedians.
I rank him very high. You know, unfortunately, for a while, he was a shlemiel for a long time. And then he became sort of a sex symbol for a while. And then he became, you know, this creepy guy who wound up with his stepdaughter and this guy who was charged with molestation. I mean, it's quite a trajectory when you think about it, because at one point he was really very beloved, and for good reasons, because he was very funny, you know, and he is one of our great filmmakers, whatever you think of him. And I know there are people who have been boycotting and won't go to another Woody Allen film. But there, in fact, let me tell you, I was in Los Angeles making an audio version of this book. This is kind of a funny story, because my publisher said they want to do an audio book, but they asked if you had any public speaking experience. almost sounds like a setup for a joke. So I go down there, and it went pretty quickly, and it went well, and I had some time on my hands, and I went to see that new Woody Allen movie, Cafe Society, and I'm sitting there watching the movie, and you know it's actually a pleasant and entertaining movie, but suddenly there's this line in it, and he used to get these lines so often that anybody who's fairly well literate or read can appreciate. The line was, you know, quoting Socrates, "The unexamined life is not worth living." And then the character says, "And you know, the examined one isn't such a bargain either." And I discovered all these old Woody Allen. You know, he does a joke about, it's one of my wife's favorites and mine too. I mean, it begins with this totally counterintuitive framing of a guy who goes out to shoot a moose. You know, here's this little shlemiel saying, "I went to shoot a moose." Some of you know the bit. I couldn't include it in my book. I had to allude to it because it was too expensive to get the royalties to. But I recommend you can just go online and put Woody Allen and the moose. And he goes and shoots the moose, but the moose is and he straps it to the fender of his car, but the moose is alive. And he realizes that he's got to do something. It's his moral obligation. So he decides he's going to go to a party. It's a costume party. He'll take the moose. And nobody will know that he had shot the moose. But he goes in there, and there's a couple dressed as a moose. And they win the costume contest. Excuse me. The moose wins the costume contest. They come in second. And the moose is enraged, and they lock antlers and everything. I won't even tell the denouement of the story, but there was that kind of genius he had for creating narratives and creating stories. And I write about it in the book. It's also some of his jokes. Some of you who know Threepenny Review, Wendy Lesser's rather high literary magazine that published out of Berkeley but has a worldwide following, she tells this Woody Allen joke. And, you know, it can make you uncomfortable in some ways because it seems anti-Semitic. But the truth of the matter is he started pushing the envelope, just like Mel Brooks did about Shoah humor, Holocaust humor. Woody Allen did with Jewish cheapness. You know, there's that line of his about this gold watch he had, and he said, "I cherish this watch. My grandfather sold me this watch on his deathbed." You know, I'm sorry. You know, there are people who are uncomfortable with that humor, understandably so. But for me, it's genius.
I have a little housekeeping. I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guest is Michael Krasny, noted interviewer and professor, who's discussing his new book about Jewish humor. You can also find video of club programs online on the club's YouTube channel.
I could tell Woody Allen stories, you know, for the rest of the time we have together, Peter, but trust me when I say a lot of the material is in the book, and a lot of material is hilarious. It used to be just like that distinction between book Jews and money Jews. There was a kind of a dichotomy between more intellectual Jews who liked Woody Allen's sense of humor and more sort of physical Jews who liked Mel Brooks or Jerry Lewis or Sid Caesar. You know, you could go on with more physical comedy like that. Mel Brooks was more, you know, shtick comedy like Shecky Green, or, you know, you can go through this list and it's just absolutely stunning and awe-inspiring how much Jews have created, you know, this whole American comedy and American humor. I mean, not created it solely, mind you, but to such a great degree that it's remarkable.
So as a Jew with an animal name, I'm particularly fond of Jewish animal jokes. And I'd love you to tell the story about the parrot who cries horny.
Well, this again is one of Leslie, my wife's favorite jokes. And there are a lot of jokes with parrots in them, Jewish jokes with parrots in them. In fact, Yom Kippur is coming up, and there's the one about the parrot that speaks perfect English, fluent English with its owner, and he takes it to services on a Friday night, and he tells everybody that the parrot speaks and davens. Not only speaks English, but davens, and it says Hebrew prayers. And this is impossible. He takes all these bets. Come on, I'll bring the parrot Friday night, you'll see. Brings the parrot. The parrot doesn't even make out a squawk, not one squawk. So he's angry at the parrot. Why didn't you know I'm losing all this money? I have to pay off all these bets. He says, wait till Yom Kippur. Anyway, what do these animal jokes allow for? They allow for a kind of transgression often, and the humor often has to do with sex or with adultery or with thievery or all kinds of things. But put it onto the animals, right? So here's a joke about a guy who goes to a pet store, and there's a real raggedy parrot, you know, it's looking like it's on its last legs, literally. And suddenly he hears the parrot and it says horny. It says the word horny and it says it repeatedly. And he goes up to the owner of the pet store and says, what's with this parrot? Yeah, he said, I can't even get rid of this. Nobody will buy it. It's the only word it knows. It says horny over and over. And again, the parrot goes, horny, horny. It's a female parrot. I don't know what to do with it. It's too old to mate or anything. He said, you want it? $10, you can have it with the cage. The guy says, okay. Takes the parrot home. Parrot's in the car in his cage. He's going, horny, horny. Takes it home. His friend comes over to see him. His friend Isaac says, what's with that parrot? The parrot says, horny, horny. He says, that's the only word it knows. Apparently, it is the only word it knows. He says, wait a minute, I've got an idea. Isaac, his friend, enterprising guy, says, he says, I know a guy, it's an acquaintance of mine, but believe it or not, he has parrots who daven all day long. You know, they're on their perches and they wear little yarmulkes and they daven. He says, I can't believe this. You know, he says, trust me, let's do this. Let's go over and see him and we can put the parrot in the cage with him, your parrot. And again, the parrot's going, horny, horny. He said, look, let's put her in the cage with these two parrots and it'll learn some pious things. It'll learn some liturgy. It'll learn some Hebrew prayers. He said, I'll try it. Why not? What do we got to lose? They go over, they drive over. Again, in the car, the parrot's going, horny, horny. They get there. And the guy can't believe his eyes. Sure enough, there are these two parrots. They're on the perch. Not only are they wearing yarmulkes and davening, you know, moving back and forth, but they got taluses on, too. Little taluses, little miniature taluses. And he said, let's do this. Let's take this female parrot, put her in the cage with the male parrots, and she'll learn maybe some davening away. They take the female parrot, they put her in the cage. First thing she does, of course, is say, horny. The two male parrots stop and say, our prayers have been answered.
So the next one, tell the joke about the two mink and why it's funny.
About the
two mink.
Oh, well, it is funny, but I also think it has a serious, just like they all do have a serious, most of them have a serious side. So there are these two minks, and they're going to the slaughter, and one says to the other, just turns to the other and says, see you in shul. All right. To think about that one a little bit, right? So, yeah. Now, you know, out here in the San Francisco Bay Area, a lot of you are transplanted Easterners, but the whole idea of shul, even a word like shul on the West Coast, doesn't necessarily carry the meaning that it does back in the East Coast. I mean, when I first came out here, I went to a synagogue in Marin County, and I thought, is that rabbi really playing a guitar? You know? I mean, and it's been a whole education since then about the different kind of Judaism we find on the West Coast. I said, I couldn't come up with any. Somebody asked me, is there a Jewish neighborhood? And I thought, well, Seacliff, maybe, you know. And I thought, Jews in San Francisco actually have Roman numerals after their name. You know, they have Christmas trees, so many of them. It's a lot of German-Jewish heritage, and I don't mean to, you know, make fun. Well, maybe I do. But look, there's this whole sense of the way women used to dress up to go to shul back in the day. And they would often, especially to show up, you know, marginal groups have always wanted to show, they have and Jewish people, black people, people who make it when they've been down or after they've been down, they like to, you know, call them nouveau riche or parvenus often, but they like to show that they've become successful and wealthy. They have Cadillacs, they have, you know, mink coats and so forth. So that's the joke, you know, you see in shul, you'll be wearing a mink stole in shul and dressing up. But the joke has a whole different subtext to it because they're going to the slaughter. And it is a joke that calls to mind the Holocaust, or the Shoah, if you would, which I prefer. And there's also something almost like the phoenix about it, because they're going to come out of the Holocaust and meet again in synagogue in this way, in some way. I mean, it's a joke about minks, but it's still a joke that has that subtextual meaning, I think.
There's another joke. It's actually one of the most complex jokes in your book. It's a real favorite. And it's about the rabbi counseling the couple with the unhappy sex life, and he tells them to hire a handsome man to wave a towel while they have sex. Would you share that with us?
Yeah. Well, you can hire him, but actually, I think in the version, see, there are a lot of different versions. This book has, the story has a towel or a talus. And I opted for the towel. But you could do it with a talus, so just hear it either way in your own mind if you like. So yeah, there's a whole chapter here on sex and marriage, and this is a couple, a man's much older, and his wife is much younger, and she's not having much pleasure in bed. By the way, let me just take a little detour here, because a lot of sexual jokes, again, show that binary. There's one about the older man who marries a younger woman, and she's about 50 and he's about 80, and he's upstairs, and she's upstairs, he's downstairs, and she yells, "Come up here and make love to me." And he says, I can't hear you. And he gets closer to the stairs. She says, "Come up here and make love to me." And he gets really right at the bottom. "I can't hear you. Say it again. Come up here and make love to me." He says, "I can't do both." All right. Now, I'll get back to the towel joke. But you compare that to the joke, for example, the old man, Rubenstein, he's 95 years old. He bangs on the door of the church, of the Catholic church, and the priest, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, the priest comes to the door and he says, "Excuse me, sir, what can I do for you?" He says, I'm Isidore Rubenstein." "Yes, but it's 2 o'clock in the morning. He says, "I came to tell you, I have a 29-year-old wife and we have sex. We have marital relations at least 3, sometimes 4 times a day." And the priest says, "I'm a Catholic priest. Mr. Rubenstein, excuse me, why are you telling me this?" "I'm telling everybody." So the towel joke. So the couple, you know, it's a much older man with a younger wife, and they're having trouble. And they go to see this rabbi because he's known for his wisdom, and he's known for actually helping people who have dysfunctional marriages or troubled marriages. And the rabbi says, "Look, this is going to sound strange, but there's a young member of this congregation. You could hire him if you want to prefer the coyote version. I'll do it this way." He says, "His name is Paul, and he's a very handsome, muscular, robust young man. I want you to go home tonight, and Paul will come to your house, and I want you to have marital relations at around 6 o'clock exactly. And Paul is going to stand there while you make love to your wife, naked. Paul has instructions for me to do this, and wave a towel in front of himself. And your wife may be stimulated. Her libido may be able to rise, and maybe better for the two of you." All right, so Paul's standing there, and he's waving the towel and everything, and nothing's happening with the wife. There's just no chemistry. There's just no excitement, no eroticism whatsoever. So they go back to the rabbi, and they say, "Rabbi, I'm sorry, your idea just didn't work." The rabbi says, "Wait." He says, "This is going to sound transgressive to you, but I think it's going to work. And it's going to sound strange, but look, we want to get some live action here in your bedroom. We want to get some real feeling going and so forth. I want you," he says to the husband, "to switch places with Paul. Paul will be there again tonight." All right. "Paul will come again tonight, 6 o'clock, and you wave the towel naked, and Paul will have marital relations, or in this case, carnal relations with your wife." So Paul shows up, and he starts making love to the wife, and the husband's standing there, and he's waving the towel and waving the towel. And the wife is screaming in ecstasy. I mean, multi-orgasmic, yelling, shouting. The husband walks over and says, "That's how you wave a towel."
So, in your book, you say that the real theme of this joke is sexual competition. But it seems to me that what might be being ridiculed is the smug self-satisfaction of a Jewish man, and it actually makes me wonder if a woman didn't write this joke.
Well, I think, again, you're onto something there. I wanted to put it in the context of male competition, and I think that's mm-hmm. really what the joke, male Jewish competition. I told an anecdote I won't go into, but because I like to pair up anecdotes with jokes too. But I think that that sense of women inventing the jokes, you know, there's so many jokes that clearly come from men about Jewish women. And a lot, you know, the Jewish American princess jokes, for example, are something that have, I understand that they disturb a lot of people because they do seem to be misogynistic and they do seem to be, not seem to be, they often are, even anti-Semitic. And yet, I wanted to put a different spin on them because I believe there is a different spin on them. Some of them just, because I think they do come mainly from men and they are a release from aggression. We're back to Freud. But it's also a way of saying, you know, we in the patriarchy, we who are the earners, you know, there's this whole, some of you who've followed Curb Your Enthusiasm may remember this whole episode where there's this whole thing about thanking the husband and the wife. Why are you thanking her, you know? I mean, I'm the one who makes a living, and what is this about thanking her? I'm just being polite, and you're supposed to thank both of the couple if you have dinner, if they're sporting you for dinner. So what I realized was that most of these jokes, and a lot of them really are making fun of women and ridiculing women and so forth, but a lot of them are actually talking about how these women have been given so much that there's a sense of joy in this too, a strange sense of joy. That is, it's patriarchy and it's, you know, I know, believe me, I know my feminist rumba and tango very well, but I don't know the steps to any other of those dances, but in terms of the ideology and seriously studying feminist ideology, but they're also saying we're proud of what we've been able to do. There's that element to it. We're proud of what we've been able, in a material comfort way, been able to. But a lot of it is just release of aggression. And yet I found that a lot of, Peter, for example, was surprised. He said, Roseanne Barr's Jewish? Yeah, Roseanne Barr was Jewish. And she said, the way to a man's heart is through his chest. you know, so I began to discover that some of this worked both ways, you know. Some of this aggression, Elaine Boozler, for example, said, and the joke has been attributed to others, but I think it was her joke. She said, yeah, my people, even in the desert, you know, the men couldn't ask anybody. They were lost for so long because they couldn't ask anybody for directions, you know. These jokes that really ridicule men. But let's face it, there's been, you know, male domination and patriarchy for long enough. So a lot, and I wanted to tackle these jokes. I got a sweet letter from a woman who said, you know, I've admired your work as a broadcaster and I admire you, but these jokes about women, you know, they bothered me. And I said, well, they bother me too. I mean, but I had to get into what they mean, and they're in there. I mean, some of them are, you really wonder, where does this aggression come from? You know, it comes from, I think, a sense of sometimes fantasizing. You know, when you start getting into some of the jokes about dead wives and everything, I think it's fantasizing. Howard Stern used to talk about, you know, he doesn't so more with his second Shiksa wife, but he used to with his first wife. I noticed these things. That jokes about losing your wife, God forbid, and all of those kinds of things, they were strangely not only releases of aggression, but, you know, kind of aggressive fantasies in a way, and the freedom that one could be having, presumably, sexually and in other ways, if one wasn't tied down to the same wife and the same woman. It goes back to the horny joke, really, in some ways.
Let me ask a parenthetical question before I get to my next one. This is from an audience member who wants you to describe that one instrumental aha moment that led you to know that you wanted to somehow be in the spotlight.
Well, this may come as a surprise.
Funny thing to ask a radio host.
Yeah, I think so. I'm not so sure I did want to be in the spotlight. That may come as a surprise, even to people who know me well. But something was driving me, and I wasn't sure what it was. I'm still not sure what it was. You know, people say, boy, you know, how do you do it? You know, every day. They used to say the same thing to Herb Cain, and people had to actually come up with something every day, whether it's a radio show or a column or whatever. And, you know, I'm at the stage of my life now where it's not even how, it's why. It's almost Kafkaesque in that sense. But I think I was driven by a neurotic energy. And probably, I think, Peter, you can relate to a lot of this.
Me?
And, you know, some people think the spotlight, you're in the spotlight, you revel in it, and, you know, it feeds your narcissism or that sort of thing. Yeah, with somebody like Donald Trump. But I don't know that that was the main driver with me. The main driver with me, believe it or not, I realized at a fairly young age was somehow, and I know this is going to sound self-serving in a way that I don't want it to, I wanted to do good. And being an educator seemed to me to be a path to that. It seemed to be a noble path to that. And for so many years, I was an educator. And really, when you think about it, moving into broadcasting was just moving into being an educator of the airways, and especially in the world of public service, which is what I found myself in. It was no mistake that Dan Shore said after he left CBS and went to BBS that he found himself in the promised land. Mm-hmm. And yet, there was discomfort with the spotlight, too. It was an ambivalent thing for me. You know, I felt at first somewhat embarrassed by it and not necessarily at ease with it. So the drivers are still something. I mean, these are reasons you go in therapy and analysis. You want to figure out what are... Rilke said something, the German poet, wonderful writer for those of you who don't know him, Rainer Maria Rilke. Rilke said, "My devils are my angels." And I think for artists, I'm sure, you know, Peter, who is a wonderful and very gifted actor and also is, you know, talented in so many ways as a writer, too, which a lot of you probably didn't know. Like me, wanted to be a novelist and started out on that path. That was really the path I thought I was going to be on. And you did, too.
A poet.
A poet, yeah.
Let me ask you, so... opposed to these kind of misogynistic jokes is a whole other genre of jokes about Jewish pussy-whipped husbands. And what we actually know about tough Jews in America, guys like my dad, my Uncle Harry, who was Frank Costello's partner in the slot machine business.
Can I put a plug in for his memoir, by the way? I mean, some great stories in there, really are. Yeah.
So... how do we square this, like, with this drive for prominence and excellence and achievement in Jewish culture, certainly in Jewish male culture, but I think really amongst men and women? Where's the pussy-whipped husband fit into this?
Well, it's not only a pussy-whipped husband. There are a lot of... I avoided that particular word, by the way. I said...
A first on public radio.
Yeah. No, I actually had vaginally whipped, and then I thought, no, that's not going to work either.
It sounds like a product.
Yeah. Well, you know, I come back to the, you know, we have helicopter moms now, and we have tiger moms and everything, but I come back to this archetypal figure of the Jewish mother. And the Jewish mother, much maligned, but also much celebrated, seen as being tough, as well as being... fostering all kinds of guilt and wanting nachas, you know, wanting joy from the children and being in some ways the prime mover. There's that scene, it's like a primal scene for Alexander Portnoy in Portnoy's Complaint, Philip Roth's famous novel, which is a lot of shtick, really, and a very funny novel. It goes back to his early career before he started writing these troubling novels about impotent old men who are half dead and suffering usually from illnesses and ailments. But there's that mother of Alexander Portnoy sitting with a knife, you know, and telling him, in effect, that he has to eat. And the fear is that he's going to be castrated by his own mother, you know, sitting there with a knife. What's he going to do with that knife? Or if not castrate him, stab him. It becomes a metaphor for these overly, shall we say, intimidating Jewish mothers, which in many ways they were, but also the Jewish mothers who were so adoring of their sons, you know. And I get into that binary in my book. I tell you one joke, though, about a Jewish mother that's in the book, and it's a joke about the tough Jewish mother at the same time that it shows a kind of practical-minded woman, very tough and practical both. So this Jewish husband is dying. He's on his last, probably his last few minutes, literally, or half hour at the most of life, and he's on his deathbed, and his daughter, dutiful daughter, is sitting there at his deathbed side, and he suddenly says, and he could barely even talk, he says, "I smell kugel," which is a Jewish noodle dish. And his daughter says, "Yeah, mommy's making a kugel." He says, "You know, just once before I die, and I know the curtain's about to come down, just to taste your mother's kugel." And the daughter says, "Of course." She runs into the kitchen. And he's literally hanging on by threads, and it's about to end. Finally, she comes down, she sits on the bed, and she folds her hand and says nothing. And he can barely even speak. He says, "Where's the kugel?" She says, "Mom says it's for after."
Michael. I can't bear to cut off a good laugh. But we've come to that portion of the evening where we're down to the last question. And since I'm the speaker here, I'll make it mine. There's a quote in your book that really caught my attention. And it wasn't really funny, but it moved me. And the quote is, "What is especially archetypical about Jewish humor is the tie it almost always has to differentness, separateness, chosenness, and loss." And there was something really mournful to me about that list. Ambivalent, mournful, and it resonated with something very deep in my psyche that I couldn't actually express until you coined those four words.
Well, thank you for that. And it's an honor to hear you say that. Maybe there's a little bit of the poet in me as well. I like to think so, you know. But I was trying in that sentence to really say something quite voluminous, and I hope that I at least came near it. You know, the thing you realize when you work with language is how ineffable certain things are. You know, how you like to think that if you have the tools of language, you can say just about, especially if you have the gift of the poet, which Peter does and I don't. It's not false humility. I wanted to be a poet before I wanted to be a novelist. Failed at both, but... See, there's that Jewish self-deprecation again. But it's a challenge to try to say things that resonate. And if that resonated for you, just as if, you know, some of these jokes resonate just with laughter. I had a hard time coming up with a title for this book, but finally it seemed right to me to say, "Let there be laughter," almost. And my publisher, Lisa Sharkey, who was great to work with from HarperCollins, had her father design this Moses-like figure who's looking upward and saying, "Let there be laughter." And my younger daughter had a friend who said, "Is that your dad's picture on the cover?" Have to laugh.
So it's that time of the night. Our thanks to Michael Krasny, host of KQED Radio's Forum.
And Peter. Thank you.
The author of the new book, Let There Be Laughter, A Treasury of Great Jewish Humor and What It Means. We want to thank our audiences in this room and on the internet and remind you that this program has been a part of the club's Good Lit series underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. We'd like to remind you, especially those people that are leaving, that copies of Michael's book will be for sale after the program and he'll be glad to sign them in the fireside room. I'm Peter Coyote, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.